This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Another week of news, another week of the government shutdown, day 28, 800,000 workers without pay, and some 8,000 local employees of the government who are struggling here in the Bay State.
What has been really stressful has been the uncertainty with when we're going to get our next paycheck, when we're going to return.
It's a stressful environment to begin with, and this has just added a whole level of anxiety and stress to everyone.
We're being instructed to do things like take up carpentry or babysit. It's a little insulting.
We have been unable to pay our rent. Our bills are piling up. We actually have a 14-day notice to quit.
And all this is having an effect on things like environmental safety and air travel.
This includes EPA inspectors who are not going out on inspections, long-term toxic waste cleanup sites that are being delayed.
It is still safe to fly, but we do have an integrated web of redundant safety layers, but we have stripped a bunch of those layers away.
So, when do we get our government back? When will the shutdown end? How will it end? Let's turn to our Week in Review panelists. With me in the studio, Tiziana Deering, professor at the Boston College School of Social Work and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Council. Tiziana, hello. Happy Friday.
Hello.
Good to have you. Also with us, Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute in Boston. Jim, always great to see you.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with reaction to the shutdown now on its 28th day. Tiziana, I'll start with you. What's your reaction? We heard those voices. People are obviously feeling the effects of this. What do you think?
Many things, actually.
Yes.
But you know what struck me right off the bat in listening to those voices? There was a report that came out about 2 years ago that said that 63% of Americans don't have enough savings to handle a $500 emergency. Mm. So, you know, that's what, 500,000 government employees across the country, about 5,000 here in the Commonwealth. When you haven't been paid in a month, that is more than a $500 emergency,
yeah.
Right? So we are talking about dire financial straits at the individual level, then combined with the lack of services that people rely on to make their lives work at the government level.
It's a really good point. Let's listen to Governor Charlie Baker. He spoke to reporters earlier this week expressing frustration with the lack of progress in Washington, even as he appreciates the concern about security at the border. Here's what he said.
My pox is on all the houses down there. Border security is a really big deal. But the inability of all of the players down there to actually get their act together and come to terms on something they can all agree to is appalling.
Let me come to you, Jim, let me just get a general reaction to you about what you're thinking about in this day 28 of this government shutdown.
Look, I think it doesn't happen very often. The Boston Globe editorial board and the Wall Street Journal's editorial board say exactly the same thing, which is there's an opportunity here. And any other time, we would have probably said there is an opportunity. Look, the president wants a wall, whether people like it or not, and I'm not making an argument you should want that, but the Democrats definitely want some protections for Dreamers and other people that are lacking protections, in part because of actions taken by the Trump administration. Again, in other times, we'd say this is an opportunity to make a deal, and I don't think the deal is one that would require $5.7 billion, as the president's asked. And I think that could be something that you would take a look at and try to do in a data-driven way. And what I mean by that is the following. We all know that the majority of drugs is coming through official ports of entry. Somewhere on the order of 5 to 20% of fentanyl, for example, is coming through non-official entry spots. So the question would be, what can you do about the 5 to 20%, which is important to give the president something in order to get what you really want, which would affect about 1.1 million people whose status is actually in question right now.
Hmm. Do you think, Tiziana, do you think that's the basis for some kind of deal? Because here's the thing that I'm beginning to feel about this. I mean, for the president, obviously, the wall is such a powerful symbol. It's an important symbol to his base. He doesn't want to give it up. But I'm also beginning to think that the no wall has become just as important a symbol to the Democrats, and they don't want to give that up because they don't want to give an inch to this president. So how do we get to what Jim's talking about where, you know, what government is supposed to do and negotiate and come up with a plan that makes everybody kind of sort of happy.
Well, so in listening to Jim, I was thinking, well, that would be predicated upon the people who are being intransigent actually wanting a deal. And right now, I don't think that's where we are. You know, it's been years since my graduate school training in negotiation, but there were a few principles we learned that are at play here. And one of them is when you make a voluble public commitment that you can be sort of held accountable to, that you're absolutely not going to do something, then guess what? You're stuck not doing it. So it does strike me that what's going to have to happen is the most intransigent people on both sides will have to not be part of the deal making.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there's got to be as much creativity in figuring out how to help all sides save face as there is in developing the deal itself if we're ever going to get out of this thing.
We spoke yesterday to former Congressman Mike Capuano about this issue. Here's a little bit of what he said. He told us his view on how one side or the other can come out ahead in this deal.
I've actually been waiting for one side or the other to start public negotiations. I think the first person who comes out with a reasonable proposal for a compromise, I think, might have a chance of, quote, winning.
That's interesting. I mean, he's talking about the first person to come out with a reasonable proposal for a compromise, but I just don't think anybody wants to be seen as compromising on this.
Anthony, let me build on Tiziana's point, because I think she makes a better point than Michael Capuano, which is...
Awesome!
Sorry. Which is...
We're very fond of Mike Capuano. I just want you to
know.
Okay, no, fine.
Nice
just
guy.
Just
all right,
to put
it.
That on the record.
No, I just want to say, I think her point, as I heard it, is... Look, you can either say no wall at all, not another dollar for the wall, or yes wall. And in that fight, you know, both of them have interest in not moving anything because they're playing to their bases. What we need is someone who is actually in Congress elected, has some position of power, Mitch McConnell or somebody, who says these are not the right conversations. The right conversations right now are about preventing more narcotics from coming into the country. That's the major issue that's afflicting lots and lots of people. Move it away from the people issue, which is really not a very significant issue, and move it to the one that actually matters to people across the country. What do we have to do to stop fentanyl from coming in? The deal there, I think, is lots more resources, lots more technology in ports of entry. And yeah, if you have to give them a little wall or this or that, in certain parts, you
some
do
metal
it plus
slats.
Technology.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, right. But you're doing it based upon what's the data-driven solution on drugs. Right. Move it away from people, move it to drugs.
Smart.
Yeah, there was an article in the Boston Globe, an editorial. No. Op-ed, I'll get it right the third time, today from a columnist who had a reader write in and say, you know, there are some other creative potential solutions here, like devolving this to the states, right, the border states, and giving them an opportunity, sort of doing a states' rights kind of approach that gives a lot of positionality to a lot of different players. So that kind of creativity and movement is going to be important. And again, it's going to require leadership from other or new places, I think, in order to get there.
So all this, of course, it's not happening in a political vacuum. The special counsel's investigation continues. And BuzzFeed reported today that President Trump personally directed his then attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. Now, if true, this would be suborning perjury, which is a crime. BuzzFeed claims the special counsel learned about this through interviews with multiple witnesses. Tiziana, if this is true, Democrats now in Congress say they're going to, in the House, say they're going to investigate whether this is true. This could be a very, very huge deal. What are you reading in that BuzzFeed story, which has been all the talk of Washington sort of all day long today?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. One, that it is a BuzzFeed story actually complicates things, because I think it allows the White House to take a position that is not a credible source. We're not even going to respond or dignify. At the same time, the first thing that struck me is every once in a while you're in a situation where you're playing, I'm going to mix like 22 metaphors here because I'm just not that good, but you're playing chess, right? And you're moving you're planning your moves carefully, and then some kind of trigger comes in and forces your hand, forces a move. And if, in fact, it becomes really clear that the president did this, it almost forces the Democrats' hand on the question of impeachment or beginning those kinds of proceedings. Because if you have clear evidence of that level of crime, and there's a history of impeaching or attempting to impeach previous presidents for that, I wonder if it doesn't back the Democratic Party into a corner about what they have to do next.
Interesting.
And that's one of the first things that I thought about when I heard the news.
So, Jim, this comes on top of recently we learned that Paul Manafort discussed a peace plan. This is, of course, Donald Trump's former campaign manager. He discussed a peace plan for Ukraine with a longtime associate who had connections to the Kremlin. He also shared political polling data with him. So even at a certain point this week, Rudolph Giuliani couldn't deny that that looked like the campaign, not Donald Trump, but the campaign colluded, although he had to back off that statement. But does it seem to you that there's just more and more evidence here of what the president has long denied, that there was collusion here?
Well, I think there are two problems for the president, obviously. One is that you've got an investigation that's now has a lot of shoe leather under it.
Yep.
At this point, and there's lots of information, lots of facts that can be released in an eyedropper sort of way. That creates the drumbeat, if you will, for congressional investigations, which will start soon. And at the end of the day, this really is a political question, right? And it's not a question of a crime per se, if the Democrats want to take it that way. I'm not saying they can get through the Senate and all that, but they can create a drumbeat that lasts and continues for another year and debilitates anything that this president would like to do. My view on this is I just watch and wait until the Mueller investigation comes out, and I think that's what I'm primarily looking for. I do think BuzzFeed has a few issues with credibility, given releases of other things related to the dossier that were probably a little problematic, but this is, at this point, not a question of BuzzFeed. This is information across all media outlets.
Right. Well, I want to bring our conversation about the week a little closer to home and talk about the state of the city. This week, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh delivered his annual speech outlining his vision for Boston. He said the state of the city is stronger than ever, pointed out that lots of people are working, low unemployment. And I thought it was sort of a rousing speech. He presented Boston as sort of this city of light that stands in contrast to the divisions of Washington and everything we're talking about, actually, a place that welcomes diversity, immigrants, believes in science. Here's a bit of what the mayor said.
If you want to grow good jobs and rebuild the middle class, look to Boston. If you want to see how social justice strengthens all of us, look to Boston. If you want to cut crime, protect the environment, lift Americans up, leave no one behind, build a more perfect union, then look to the city of hopes and hearts. Look to the city of courage and champions. At a time when cities must lead, look to Boston.
So, Tiziana, pretty good moment in that speech. But what did the mayor leave out? Sure, it's obviously it's his job in an event like that to talk about what's great and what works in Boston. But what did he leave out?
Well, and I do want to give a nod to how much fun it is to listen to somebody who loves his job.
Absolutely. No, he made that really, really clear.
It's actually really refreshing, right? That the guy just loves his job and loves his city. What he left out is economic inequality combined with economic mobility. And the fact that that both here and across the United States is heavily correlated with race, and that we have massive challenges to solve in the city about really achieving people's ability to climb the economic ladder if they want to and they're trying, and to create a kind of mobility that constantly renews our middle class, constantly allows new people to become part of the vibrant innovation of our community, gives hope to our children, et cetera. And yes, that's a problem that faces every major American city, but both the potential for the problem and the potential for the solution are on steroids in Boston.
Yeah, interesting. Jim, what did you hear in the mayor's State of the City address, or what did you not hear that you wished you had heard?
Let me address both, actually.
Yeah.
So the first thing is I think anybody who lives here has to recognize that this is one of the greatest historical periods for Boston. I mean, it's just an incredible moment for Boston, just so many fronts, innovation, the growth of the city, the changing face of the city, changing leadership in the city. Just things are moving. They feel like they're all moving in the right place. And I think that's a lot to say about choices that were made by previous policymakers and investments that were made, and the fact that we got Harvard and MIT and, yes, Boston University and Boston College, sorry. but just a lot of brains and a lot of ability to drive innovation and kind of really newfangled cool stuff that the private market's able to do that's actually solving some problems. So that's all fantastic. What I heard as an underlying current is that he talked a lot about equity in jobs, a lot about equity in housing, but not a lot about how they were going to get there. I heard a lot about $300 million new investment in schools. in a 127 school district, $300 million is not a lot of money. And then on top of that, what I didn't hear, and this is what I think people of color particularly care about, we heard a lot about how there's a new police commissioner who's of color, but we heard almost nothing. I don't remember anything. I may be wrong. There might be one line in there about the performance of the Boston public schools. And that is disheartening because that's the talent pool of the future. That's the ability to actually have the flow of people who are going to go into leadership later on. And it is troubling.
Yep. And he talked about the investment in buildings. But I think you're right. He did not talk about the performance of the schools as individual institutions of education. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point. So time is ticking. So I want to move on to one more story this week. State Attorney General Maura Healey is taking on OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma and its owners for their alleged role in the opioid epidemic.
I promise you that we will hold opioid makers accountable for the role they played in creating this crisis. And we will do whatever it takes to hold this company accountable and to get the justice our families so deserve.
So that was Maura Healey speaking at her inauguration on Wednesday, one day after filing a complaint against Purdue, alleging that the company and its owners continued to aggressively market OxyContin to Massachusetts doctors and patients, even though they knew it was highly addictive, highly dangerous. And the complaint outlines the ties that the Sackler family and executives at Purdue had to Massachusetts institutions and names individuals at the Sackler in the Sackler family. Tiziana, this seems like a pretty bold move here and in a really important case. How does this strike you?
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV, but it does strike me a couple of things. One, you say a bold move, but I admit that my reaction is it's a necessary move.
Yep.
That the courts are going to be part of what is necessary to obtain accountability, to obtain funding, et cetera, to counteract an opioid crisis that was at least in part seeded by the product that this company makes. I think it'll be, I listened to coverage on this show earlier this week where Nancy Gertner, the legal specialist, talks about, it's the devil's in the details.
Right.
But from an ethics standpoint, it is really hard to imagine that one doesn't look at this and conclude that this company and this family behaved unethically, created a wave of human misery and then didn't pump the brakes. And that, I think that matters. And if this is what it takes to bring that kind of accountability to light, then I think it's quite important.
Well, you mentioned former federal judge Nancy Gertner. Let's listen to her. She described this issue and said it all has to do with what Purdue knew about the drugs they were marketing and when they knew that.
Everyone is trying to pump up sales. The issue is whether or not they're doing it when they know the risks, doing it with respect to categories of people whose when they're taking the drug is particularly risky.
So, Jim, like so many cases like this, it comes down to what did they know and when did they know it?
No, I agree. And I agree with the statement that everyone's trying to pump up sales. The thing I'd say is that the rhetoric from the Sackler family might be more appropriate if you're dealing with a cholesterol-lowering drug, but you're dealing with something that's highly addictive and it was known to be highly addictive pretty early. As a policy guy, what I think about is how to avoid this in the future. And I think one of the things we should not do is just buy the media narrative. This is only about Purdue. Purdue is culpable and should be punished. And I think it's pretty clear that's coming. But there's a lot about careless physicians who are prescribing this stuff like candy. There's medical schools that were not really training people in addiction. There are wholesalers who are sending lots and lots of drugs to, if you take a look at the population areas they're sending them to, way well beyond what's anything even remotely reasonable, all the way down to the medical profession that was trying to push down on pain levels and saying that you had to get rid of pain for people in a way that probably would lead to overprescription of this sort of thing. So we need to think about this holistically after the fact of punishing them.
Yeah.
About how to prevent this sort of thing in the future.
Well, it's interesting. The case brings to my mind a successful case against Big Tobacco back in the 1990s when all those states, including Massachusetts, recouped hundreds of billions of dollars from tobacco companies. That took a long time. So I have a feeling we're going to be watching this story for many years to come. So before we run out of time, I want to end with the hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Tiziana, what was your hubbub?
So I want to put two together. There are a number of organizations in the Commonwealth that use food types of businesses to help proven risk youth who are exiting an incarceration. And we have several that are sort of known nationally for how good they are. This week, one of them, which is the Bakery Cafe end of Haley House. Mm-hmm. They employ people who are exiting incarceration. They use the funds from that Bakery Cafe.
In Dudley Square, right.
Had to close the Bakery Cafe operations as a result of gentrification in Dudley, and they don't know what their business model is going to be to reopen. At the same time, UTEC, another one in Lowell, received the first Social Justice Fund award from the New England Patriots this week. And I think that the sort of ups and downs, highs and lows and rises and falls of excellent programs that do excellent work for at-risk people but fall prey to other economic factors is just really striking. I love both those organizations. I love what they do. I'm thrilled for UTEC. I'm heartbroken for the Haley House Cafe. And we got to get behind these organizations and support what they do more and more.
Hear, hear. Jim,
your I have hubbub. A less uplifting hubbub.
Oh, man.
So, sorry about that. Hubbubs are supposed to be below the fold stories.
Yes.
And mine at the start of the next semester, the second semester, is about Hampshire College, which is folding. And look, we've seen Mount Ida, we've seen Newbury College, Hampshire College. Now, the pattern is clear. These are liberal arts colleges. They're small. They do not have substantial endowments, and this is just going to accelerate. I know lots of people think there's online courses that are taking pieces of the market. I don't believe that. I actually believe it's much more STEM has risen over the past decade. The number of kids coming out with STEM degrees is by 43%, and liberal arts has actually declined over that period. This is running away from high cost, no jobs coming out of college. And this is, I think, in part a reflection of what people are thinking about the humanities these days and the way they are taught, that being a controversial statement, I know. But it's something that Massachusetts has to think about, particularly because of the rich history of small liberal arts colleges here.
Mm, I think it's a really fascinating point. Thanks for that. So my hubbub is about this rare astronomical phenomenon happening Sunday night. It's going to take place toward the end of the big conference championship game between the Patriots and the Chiefs. So if you don't feel like sitting around and watching grown men concuss each other, step outside at about 9:30, look up at the sky, and you might see that super blood wolf moon. I love that name. And we're talking about a total lunar eclipse, which occurs when the Earth lines up between the sun and the moon, coupled with the moon being ever so slightly closer to the Earth. But it might be snowing, so when you're looking up, be careful not to get hit by a rampaging snowplow. And because it's snowing, you might not be able to see the moon at all. So in that case, well, never mind.
For a second there, I thought you were referring to Tom Brady as a rare astrological phenomenon.
Well, he might well be. Tiziana Deering, professor at the Boston College School of Social Work, thanks for coming in. We really appreciate it.
It was great to be
here.
Have
a great weekend. And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you.
Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend. Stay with us. Coming up, there's a lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.